With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, the citrus yellow vein clearing virus is found in Los Angeles County, and the USDA is now accepting applications for the 1890 National Scholars Program. But our top story today, Bear, victorious in a California trial initiated by a man who claimed he had developed cancer from long-term exposure to the company's Roundup weed killer. Reuters says that ended what had been a 5-trial losing streak for the company in trials over similar claims. Bear says the verdict was handed down by a jury in California Superior Court late last week. In a statement, the company says the verdict was, quote, consistent with the evidence in this case that Roundup does not cause cancer and is not responsible for the plaintiff's illness. Lawyers for the plaintiff, Bruce Jones, did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Like most plaintiffs in other Roundup lawsuits, Jones claimed the product caused him to develop a form of cancer called non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Around 165,000 claims have been made against the company for personal injuries allegedly caused by Roundup, which Bayer acquired by purchasing Monsanto in 2018. Geopolitical factors, elections, and many other surprises await the agricultural economy in 2024, that according to Farm Journal and Purdue University's December Economist Monthly Monitored. It shows views slightly more optimistic than they were a month ago. When asked what they would not be surprised to see, the responses included China falling into a big recession. They wouldn't be surprised to see a second farm bill extension or corn prices that test $4 again, and inflation that supports managed money returning to the commodities. Record beef imports would not be a surprise, as well as a national corn yield bigger than 190 bushels per acre. There are also reasons for optimism, like demand opportunities through domestic soybean crushing, renewable fuel, and sustainable aviation fuel. They're looking for robust domestic consumption and an opportunity for competitive pricing for U.S. commodities in overseas markets. They say many producers should still have strong balance sheets. Now here's Brian German with the latest Chill Hour report.
In this week's California Chill Hour report, brought to you by Dormex, wake up your buds with Dormex. UC Cooperative Extension Orchard Systems Advisor Kat Jarvis Sheehan highlights some of her work looking at helping trees to compensate for a lack of chill accumulation.
So for a long time, we would talk about this chill accumulation and then not have a lot of resources in the toolbox if we weren't going to get enough chill. Just told the growers, like, sorry. But yeah, UC has been working hard with a number of chemical companies have been working to get into the market to put tools in the toolbox for growers that maybe the fruit folks had traditionally, but the nut crop folks did not. So I'm working with the Walnut Board and CDFA and a number of these companies, including Alschem, which manufactures Dormex. We've been looking at Dormex, which is one of the brand names for hydrogen cyanamide, CAN-17, and Erger, which is a fancy nitrogen cocktail. All of those for increasing bud break and moving bud timing earlier in response to inadequate chill in walnuts. And we're finding that all of those have a strong response in moving bud break timing. Certain years, they've even, like, especially Dormex, has been able to essentially compensate for lack of chill in terms of bud break timing. So we have some treatments that, you know, we heat up in these big tents and then we don't give them anything. And we see, like, okay, if we applied Dormex, for example, can it make things open up as early as if the trees had gotten enough chill, these neighboring trees? And they've been good at that. And we've had some initial data that's showing also Dormex is helpful at increasing bud break in general, not just moving the timing of bud break.
Jarvis Sheehan's research in walnuts is proving to be invaluable for walnut growers that are dealing with a lack of chill in their orchards. We will be checking back in to see how the research at UC Davis progresses, and while Dormex continues being tested, it's currently labeled in California for use in walnuts. And information from the UC Davis chill calculator shows that as of December 27th, the Shafter Sima station has logged 24.9 portions under the dynamic model with 445 hours below 45 degrees. The station in Five Points has registered 25.4 portions with 475 hours. There have been 600 hours in Merced with 26.5 cumulative portions. In Manteca, there have been 470 chill hours, equating to 29.3 portions. Finally, the Sima station in Durham has registered 31.8 portions with 531 hours. And this has been the California Chill Hour Report, brought to you by Dormex. Tune in next week for another episode.
I'm Sabrina Halvorsen, and we will be back in just a moment. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, studies prove the effectiveness of USDA's Women, Infants, and Children's Program. Experts say it's more than a nutrition program. Gary Crawford has more.
Some experts say if Congress fails to come up with a budget bill that fully funds the Agriculture Department's Nutrition Program for Low-Income Women, Infants, and Children, WIC for short,
states will have no choice but to cut the number of people they serve.
States may need to cut participation by 2 million people by next September.
This is especially troubling because WIC serves nearly 40% of all infants in the United States.
That last voice belongs to USDA Deputy Secretary Sochil Torres-Small, and the other day she joined several WIC program supporters in telling reporters about the benefits of this nearly 50-year-old program.
We've seen that it drives down health care costs and increases preventative care. Studies show that WIC decreases infant deaths, premature births, and also reduces the risk of low birth weights. And in early childhood, WIC participation is also associated with higher test scores.
Other experts echo those findings. Grace Ho is Illinois' deputy governor for Health and Human Services. She says year after year, study after study, they all show the same result.
Families who participate in WIC have longer and safer pregnancies with fewer premature births and infant deaths, improved dietary and academic outcomes for our littlest ones, and moms are healthier. And two, WIC participants show significant savings in healthcare costs, decreasing the rate of low birth weight babies and earlier detection of prenatal health risks.
The WIC program does all of this by helping low-income women and children to purchase special supplemental nutritious foods. The program also provides personalized nutrition information and health care referrals. Just last week, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, talking with reporters, said the WIC program is about more than just nutrition assistance.
It's a program that obviously provides significant benefits, not just to their recipients, but also to the farmers whose products make up the WIC package. And at the end of the day, one would hope that in the strongest and most powerful country in the world, that we could find sufficient resources to adequately fund a program that helps women, infants, and children.
A program which President Biden says makes a significant contribution to his overall goal, which is
end hunger in this country by the year 2030.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's Livestock News, Pork Quality Assurance Plus version 5.0, PQA Plus Site Assessment version 5.0, and Transport Quality Assurance version 8 have been certified to be ISO, or International Organization for Standardization, compliant with the International Animal Welfare Standards. Stephanie Wetter, Director of Animal Welfare and Sustainability at the National Pork Board, explains how this accomplishment underscores pork producers' dedication to providing pigs with an environment that is healthy, safe, and sustainable.
The recognition of USDA for this ISO compliance clearly shows that animal welfare is a top priority for our U.S. pork producers, and our pork importers and our consumers all around the globe can rest assured that the American pork that they consume is produced in accordance with the highest animal welfare standards in the world.
ISO's animal welfare technical specification was designed to evaluate if animal welfare programs meet international standards for animal care across the supply chain. Importers will see the value in the ISO compliance.
Here and now, our U.S. pork is able to stand out among their international competitors with this animal welfare designation, and our international consumers can continue to have confidence that the U.S. pork that they're consuming is going to be safe, consistent, and a quality protein source.
Stressing that this ISO designation doesn't bring any more work to the pork producer.
Instead, what it's doing is it's providing validation that the training, certification, and practices that our producers are already doing on farm are going to be recognized. And what's more, our U.S. pork producers can still rest assured that they only need to comply with existing programs on their farm. So that's PQA Plus and TQA, and not potentially a myriad of other guidelines in order to sell their product internationally.
As an independent, international standard-setting body, ISO works with the World Organization for Animal Health to help farmers and animal welfare programs determine how to implement species-specific animal welfare standards. Visit porkcheckoff.org to review the full release. In other livestock news, the latest edition of a USDA annual report provides snapshots of our nation's farm and ranch operations over the 2022 calendar year. Rod Bain has findings from the study in this report.
It's a family business, farming, for the most part.
Small family farms made up 88% of the farm count and operated 46% of the farmland, but generated only 19% of the total value of production.
USDA economic researcher Catherine Lacey, presenting findings from the latest edition of America's Farms and Ranches at a Glance report. Other information gleaned from the report for the 2022 calendar year includes what size farm produced what type commodity.
Large-scale family farms dominate the production of most commodities, including beef, hogs, cash grains and soybeans, cotton, dairy, and specialty crops. In the remaining two commodities, poultry and eggs, and hay, small family farms and mid-sized family farms dominate the production.
Operating profit margins for farms were also studied.
OPM is a benchmark for an operation's financial health. Operations with low OPM may be at a high risk for financial stress. Most small family farms have an operating profit margin in the high-risk zone. At least 90% of low-sale, off-farm occupation, and retirement farms earn a majority of their income from off-farm sources. So the farm business being profitable is not necessarily essential to the survival of the farm household.
Among the other focus areas and findings within the America's Farm and Ranches at a Glance report,
the share of farms with a low-risk operating profit margin varied by farm size in 2022. About 26% of all U.S. farms held any debt in 2022, and the majority, which was 67% of farms with debt, used only one lender.
Farm households in general were not considered low income or low wealth. Also,
among socially disadvantaged farm operations, non-Hispanic black farms in particular differ most compared to non-Hispanic white farms in terms of size, specialization, and financial outcomes.
And when it comes to socially disadvantaged farms and their operating profit margins,
at only 8% of operations, non-Hispanic black farm operations are less likely to have an OPM in the low-risk zone compared to all other race and ethnicity groups.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
For AgNet West, I'm Will Jordan.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service confirmed the presence of citrus yellow vein clearing virus in the Hacienda Heights area of Los Angeles County. The find was made during a routine multi-pest survey conducted by the California Department of Food and Agriculture. The finding marks the second area in California where the virus has been detected after first being discovered in Tulare County in March 2022. CDFA is surveying residential properties within a one-mile radius around the initial find site in Los Angeles County to fully determine the extent of the disease's presence in the area. The virus can spread through grafting and the movement of infected materials and rootstocks and contaminated tools and equipment. Insect vectors include green citrus aphid, Mellinor cotton aphid, citrus whitefly, and cowpea aphid. As of now, there's no treatment for the virus, so the best mitigation measures are to control the vectors and sanitize tools and equipment. American Farmland Trust has released policy recommendations to help guide land use and solar development, addressing concerns about the impact on food security and rural economies. AFT notes the expansion of solar projects is inevitable and their recommendations aim to shape the development process. The report projects the need for over 10 million acres of solar to decarbonize the electric grid by 2050, with 90% expected in rural areas. Without policy changes, 83% of future solar development may occur on farmland. AFT's Smart Solar Principles focus on empowering communities in solar development decisions, setting standards for soil health protection, promoting agrivoltaic projects, and ensuring equity in farm viability. The recommendations also extend to Congress, advocating for the inclusion of these principles in the next Farm Bill. AFT aims to balance the benefits of solar energy with the preservation of farmland and community interests. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is currently accepting applications for the USDA 1890 National Scholars Program until March 1st. The initiative, managed by the USDA's Office of Partnerships and Public Engagement, encourages students at 1890 land-grant universities to pursue careers in food and agriculture. The program's open to eligible high school seniors entering their freshman year of college and rising sophomores and juniors. The program provides full tuition, fees, books, and room and board. Recipients pursue degrees in agriculture, food, natural resource sciences, or related disciplines, and gain work experience through USDA summer internships. In the 2023 cohort, the program awarded 100 scholarships. The initiative aims to cultivate a skilled workforce for USDA and the broader U.S. agriculture sector while supporting the career development of future leaders in the field. A complex of different fungi can cause a variety of trunk diseases in grapevines. Research plant pathologist with USDA's Agricultural Research Service, Kendra Baumgartner, explains where ESCA fits into the picture of grapevine trunk diseases.
There's several different diseases. ESCA and all of these other trunk diseases attack the permanent woody structure of the vine. That's why we call them trunk diseases. They're in the woody trunk, they're in the cordons, they're in the spurs, but they're not typically in the green shoots. Or the roots, we don't think. ESCA is not one of the most common trunk diseases in California, but it's found all over the world, wherever grapes are grown. Even though we grow some of the same cultivars in both Europe and California, it's a bigger disease problem there than it is here. And then when I talk about trunk diseases in general, the other trunk diseases, other than ESCA, they include diseases like Eutypa dieback, Botrytis spherea dieback, Phomopsis dieback. They are all very similar in that they cause a dieback type symptom where the shoots get more and more stunted every year, growing out of the same spur, or the same side of the vine, and eventually they die back or they just don't grow at all. But ESCA is a little different in that it doesn't typically cause that dieback type symptom.
The South Sacramento Valley Processing Tomato Production Meeting is coming up soon. The meeting covers Colusa, Sacramento, Solano, Sutter, and Yolo counties. It's going to be held at the Woodland Community and Senior Center on Tuesday, January 9th. Cassandra Sweat from the UC Davis Department of Plant Pathology will be providing updates on regional diseases in the Sacramento Valley and providing information on equipment sanitation to help slow the spread of soil-borne pests and pathogens. Other topics of discussion include knot nematodes and southern blight management, varietal and chemical controls for fusarium diseases, and branched broom rape management. Fresno County Vegetable Crops Farm Advisor Tom Torini will also be going over the impact of neonicotinoid regulations on insecticide programs for managing insect-transmitted viruses. More information on the meeting is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
This is the Agnet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back. We go now to Chuck Zimmerman for a look at ag policy.
I'm visiting with Ethan Lane with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. And Ethan, on the political front, we've just had an announcement just yesterday. So brand new. Tell us a little bit about what happened in D.C.
Well, after weeks of sort of uncertainty with the change in leadership in the House of Representatives, the failure of multiple spending bills, and kind of the general partisan rancor we've all been watching, it was refreshing to see the House come together under Speaker Mike Johnson's leadership, get a spending package moved out of that body earlier this week. It's a laddered CR, laddered continuing resolution is what they're calling it. It splits those funding packages up into two different expiration dates next year. One is January 19th, the other is February 2nd. And that gives everybody in D.C. a little bit more of a sort of a spread out range of targets. It makes, I think, the prospect of a shutdown for those that are looking for that and want it a little less alluring by breaking it up and having a little less impact on the American people if there was a lapse in funding one way or another. But by and large, really good news to see that bill pass the House, and now just in the last few hours last night pass the Senate. It's now headed to the president's desk, and added bonus, it includes a farm bill extension through the end of the year, so it takes a little bit of the pressure off for some of the commodity groups that were concerned about that as well.
We still have a little while to go before the end of this year. Are there any other ones kind of on the edge that might get moved before in the election year?
Well, as far as the underlying appropriations process, the House has passed seven of those 12 appropriations bills. through their full process. The Senate, I believe, has done three of theirs. We are still seeing kind of a stop and start approach. A couple of those bills have gone to the floor and been pulled because they didn't have the votes, have lost. And that's sort of an ongoing process of figuring out where this Republican conference is and what they can get behind. You have those hardliners that really want to see major cuts. We saw that with the Ag Appropriations Bill in September, where that bill came out of committee with about an 8% cut to programs across the board. By the time it went to the floor, it was a 35% cut. And that was too much for farm state Republicans to bear. And that bill was voted down not by the radicals. It was voted down by moderate farm state Republicans that said, I can't go home and face the farmers and ranchers in my district with this bill.
So what's your outlook for next year?
Well, you know, whenever you have a contentious presidential election, which I think it's safe to say that we do, and hotly contested House races and Senate races around the country, narrow margins on Capitol Hill, it's very hard to get Washington to pay attention to block and tackle policy issues. I always sort of start looking at the calendar in a year like this that we're coming into, an election year, and from a strategic perspective, you kind of feel like anything that happens after June is going to get lost in the shuffle. So you kind of want to get your work done in Washington in a year like this early, because there just isn't any oxygen left at the end of the year to deal with it. So I think this year is definitely going to be that kind of feeling in Washington. So it should be a busy winter, a busy spring, and then everyone's attention is going to turn to that horse race.
Thank you very much. That's Ethan Lane with NCBA. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
A look ahead at ag trends for the coming year. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. As agriculture looks to 2024, the Ag Innovation Consultancy Company, AgriAuthority, put together its top 10 trends for the new year. The company is seeing some consistency from prior years, but some emerging trends as well. The first is a push for biologicals and biostimulants, comparing them to what seed treatments were in the 1990s. Biostimulant market should reach $6.8 billion by 2028. They say climate-smart farming will get smarter as measurements behind the carbon market continue maturing. AgriAuthority says precision ag will continue evolving with the onset of AI. The company's top 10 also says that sustainability is not going away, plus soil health will continue evolving. Artificial intelligence will likely be more present in agriculture in the next year. They call 2024 a shakeout year as companies will make moves for the future as competition increases. That real Christmas tree can have many uses far after the holidays are over. Gary Crawford has more.
Seems like it was no time at all since we first started singing that song, but now the holidays are starting to wind down. And soon it'll be time to take down that old Christmas tree. Oh yes, always a sad task for me. It's like losing a friend. But in most cases, that real tree is going to be reincarnated to yet another even more useful life. Now, 10 years ago, those trees got picked up and put into the garbage dump, and that was it. But not today.
Most cities and municipalities will have curbside pickup of real Christmas trees, and they'll take those and they'll chop them up for mulch or make some use of them like that.
But Kansas State University forester Charlie Barton tells me besides just putting the tree out to be picked up,
there's several good ways you can use an old Christmas tree.
So here are a few of those good ways. First, Charlie says at his house.
What we do is we quite often will take a leftover tree and tie it up to the corner of the deck right near our bird feeder. And so it gives a place for the birds to perch and to get out of the wind on a cold night or to get into the thick cover when a cat comes by and looking for an easy meal.
And if you don't have a bird feeder, you can
make the tree itself into a big bird feeder by stringing popcorn or putting peanut butter in a pine cone and rolling it in seeds or putting extra bacon grease into a cut orange or grapefruit halve. And the birds will come and peck out that and eat some of the fruit and eat some of the fat, too.
Or if you have cold-sensitive lawn or garden plants out there, Charlie says just
take a clipper and clip off all the branches and use the boughs as extra mulch around some of your semi-hardy perennials, some of the flowers or rose bushes in the garden that sometimes get damaged by the severe cold, by having several layers of evergreen boughs right over the crown of the plant. And then when it snows and it settles it in, helps provide a good insulation, helps reduce winter kill.
And on a different scale, there are underwater uses for old Christmas trees.
We just usually take a half a cinder block or so and a stout piece of rope to tie it onto the base of the tree and sink it into a pond. And it kind of acts like a mini coral reef. different vegetation, algae, plants will grow around on the branches, and that'll attract young fish and small minnows like that, and the larger fish will come in to the shade and the shelter provided by the sunken tree.
Or some beach towns put old trees to good use.
We've seen some used for erosion on sand dunes. I'm actually from Rhode Island, from the East Coast, and they take some Christmas trees and anchor them in the sand to help the blowing sand stop erosion on the coast.
There's one use for that old tree that Charlie Barton does not recommend, and that's burning it in the fireplace.
That can be dangerous with the pitch pockets, and the moisture in the tree can make little explosions and send sparks across the room.
Or shoot live embers into and out of the chimney, possibly starting a fire. Not the best way to say so long to that beautiful Christmas tree. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Chuck Zimmerman joins us once again with this featured interview.
I'm visiting with Dave Armstrong, and Dave, I know you're chairman for ASTA. Tell us, first of all, a little bit about yourself and your company.
So I'm the president and CEO of Cicada America Holding Company, so I'm responsible for all of Cicada's activity in North America, Central America, and some parts of South America and Oceania. Cicada is a 110-year-old publicly traded company focusing in vegetable and flower genetics, and we're based in California. We're actually going through a process now, moving our headquarters from Morgan Hill, California, just south of San Jose, up towards Woodland near Sacramento. So that's a big move going on in the company now. But we've been established in the U.S. for nearly 50 years and have enjoyed a lot of success in developing genetics in the vegetable space for the U.S. and Mexico market especially.
So as chairman, when does that change to in your term?
So the term is the term is 1 year as chairman, and it begins in July 1 and goes through June. That's our year. But ASTA really has you make a commitment to the board in this process. We call it three up, three down. So you're basically making a 6-year commitment to the board, right? So as vice chair, then second vice to vice, and then chair, and then you remain on the board for a couple of years. But yeah, it's a 1-year commitment as chairman.
Well, I congratulate you on that. What I would like to talk about a little bit is this newly named conference. I'm still trying to say it fluently, but the Field Crop Seed Convention here. How has that name change gone well with members?
The name change seems to be going okay, but I think you pointed to, right, the change pain. There's always going to be there. I mean, this has been known for decades as CSS, so certainly we don't expect people to just automatically get the new name. But, I think it better conveys, what goes on at this convention. So far we're not seeing any real resistance to the new name.
How about the venue? I mean, 40 years in the same hotel. I think Cindy and I, who are doing work for you all, this is our 12th one of these. So, yeah, we were kind of used to that, too. But as Bruce Knight said here this morning on his panel, this is climate change. He was joking about the weather here versus up there. But we do have pretty good weather.
Weather has been a big factor in the decision here to move to Florida, of course, right? But there were other things, with the Chicago venue that made it really – not sustainable, I think, in future costs, weather, difficulty in just setting up and managing the logistics of the event. So that is all pointed to this significant move. And for sure, it's a milestone in this kind of keystone event of ASTA. So far, so good. We'll see. I mean, it's our first run here in Orlando, and the feedback I'm getting from attendees is generally positive. Some folks have pointed out some things that we can improve on with the venue, with the approach to the show. We're going to be taking that to our event management team, our excellent event management team, and looking for ways that we can improve this going forward. But so far, so good.
Yeah, that, and I think that's to be expected. There's probably going to be a survey, and I could see that there are things that people may make suggestions, and that happens every year, really. I've seen this event, even over those years, have some major changes at times. So how about talking about the organization itself? What right now, as you are going to leave here, are the things, issues, whatever you're going to be working on as you move forward?
Well, we just sat through a really interesting panel on conservation and cover crops. That's certainly one of the things that ASTA has been spending a lot of time on, because that's an emerging and rapidly evolving segment for the seed industry. Treated seed is another issue that's really important for the industry. That's increasingly being targeted by, kind of opponents of agriculture. The farm bill, obviously, we spend a lot of time asked to, our elite, policy team spent a lot of time on the farm bill, making sure that we just protect the free movement of seed around the world, and also innovation, that the regulatory environment around innovation is not constraining, some of these really important techniques like gene editing and others that are becoming increasingly important to developing new genetics to serve farmers and ultimately provide a secure and affordable food supply to everyone.
Do you have work being done at all on this whole thing called carbon and the sequestration of carbon, and has that had an impact on some of the things that you're doing?
Well, again, ASTA spends a lot of time on the broad area of sustainability. We've recently added, a sustainability pillar to the ASTA strategic plan. And, of course, we're working with our member companies who have varying, degrees of sort of sophistication in their sustainability programs. To be sure, this is something that we'll be involved in monitoring and helping to develop as we go forward, because it's going to be an increasingly important part of the sort of agriculture industry's ability to adapt to this new world of measuring carbon output again, as we heard in this very interesting panel, there's a lot of advanced programs already in process there, and for sure this is going to evolve. So yeah, it's an important area for ASTA, absolutely.
Well, another important area is this word called leadership, and that's another program that you've put together, and sounds to me like a great one for some of the member companies to get involved with some of their staff, for example.
Absolutely, and we are really excited about the ASTA Leadership Summit coming up next June in Nashville, Tennessee, just a really exciting venue. We have been working on that leadership summit over these last few years to adapt it to the needs of the seed industry. So again, while there are many leadership programs out there, the ASTA Leadership Summit does provide kind of that unique angle for the seed industry and for ASTA itself to draw folks into ASTA, especially, newer or emerging leaders in organizations to get involved in the industry. We're excited about the direction the summit has been going over these past couple of years, and we're particularly excited about the Nashville event coming up in June next year. So we really urge all people interested in leadership organized around the seed industry to join the event next year.
Before we close, anything else you'd like folks to know about ASTA that we didn't touch on?
ASTA's in great health. We have great leadership with Andy Levine and a really dynamic staff. They do a tremendous amount of work for the industry. We try to tell that story every day, but a lot of our members, of course, are busy, running their businesses and may or may not be aware of that. But your organization is an important part of of keeping the seed industry viable. And I'm excited to be part of ASTA and certainly part of the leadership.
Well, thank you very much, Dave, for taking time to visit with me here. We are at the ASTA Field Crop Seed Convention. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
Thank you, Chuck. This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we will be right back. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. Precision agriculture has come a long way in recent years and will continue to develop quickly. Matt Olson, the Precision Ag Manager for John Deere, says off-farm folks might not know how much automation there is on American farms today.
A lot of people that aren't on a farm don't realize how much automation is taking place on the farm. So when we look at the past 10 years, we've really accelerated the amount of automation of these machines. So as the automotive industry talks about how they have self-driving cars, we've really had self-driving tractors since 2002. The farmer had to be in the cab, but that tractor or combine or sprayer drove itself through the field to maintain that production that that farmer was looking at.
It's easier than ever for busy farmers to stay up on the latest precision agriculture.
Farmers got a lot on their plate, right? And they've already made a lot of investment in precision ag. They're using AutoTrac, they're using section control, so they have the foundational technology that they need. I want them to think about how can they get new value from what they already have without even needing to buy a whole lot of new things. A lot of the updates, a lot of enhancements are software oriented, so they're easy for a farmer to get their hands on, try it, experience the value, and make the decision whether or not that's something that they want to invest in.
There's a lot of opportunity ahead in the field of precision ag.
Whether it's working for a company like Deere, or I would really even challenge folks to say, you know what, we love living in Wisconsin. It's a beautiful state. Our family's there. Our friends are there. That's where I want to stay. But I want to be involved in technology. Our John Deere dealers have a significant investment in people that are experts in technology working with farmers day in and day out. So there's a great opportunity for folks that are interested in agriculture and technology to be able to say, I can stay where I'm at and have a wonderful career. And then there's opportunities within companies like John Deere, whether it's building software, my role is in marketing and communications. There's so many different opportunities.
In other news, foreign ownership of U.S. farmland grew last year, according to a recent USDA report, but not for a key U.S. adversary. Foreign entities bought nearly 3.5 million acres of U.S. farmland and forest in 2022, which is up more than 8% to more than 43 million acres. But China's holdings fell a bit from 2021 to 350,000 acres, less than 1% of foreign-owned acres. Still too much for Washington State Republican Dan Newhouse.
This is about our country's national security and ensuring that adversaries like China, like Russia, like North Korea, or Iran do not gain a foothold on American soil.
Especially near sensitive U.S. military sites, as China is accused of doing in North Dakota. That's a threat that Pentagon Assistant Secretary Eli Ratner said the administration takes seriously.
Absolutely support efforts to prevent adversarial ownership of sensitive land, industries and sectors, and biotechnology is one we're taking a careful look at.
That includes legislation Newhouse introduced to broaden the U.S. Treasury Department's control over foreign U.S. farmland ownership.
The People's Republic of China is only interested in reaping every possible benefit from U.S. land without giving back or considering our future to sustain an independent energy and food production. The U.S. cannot become dependent on our adversaries for our domestic food supply.
Senate legislation also requires USDA to have a permanent seat on the Treasury's Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., or CFIUS, which sponsors may try to include in a new farm bill. USDA plans to update how it collects data to study the impact of foreign land holdings on rural communities and the exact location of foreign-owned acres. That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.